All right, well, the poems are going to go back and forth between a couple of locations, as Kit suggested. Starting in Galway, moving out to Minnesota, and a couple of points in between, also a couple of virtuality points in between. Some poems from the first book, which is called Thumbs Width, and more poems from the second book, which is called Mood, which features a long poem that's about internet gaming. Can you actually hear me from here? Is that okay? Right. All right, well, the first poem, since gaming is part of the theme, the first poem is about playing games, and it's about a certain kind of avatar. I believe James Cameron is producing a three-dimensional film using the new technology called Avatar. We're going to be hearing a lot about avatars, and some of you presumably have a few avatars of your own. And this is about the more simple technology of avatars that we used to use as children, my brother and myself. Basically, it's a poem about toy soldiers and the little model men that we all remember so well. And this is called War and Peace. It was a war of inches on the shore when we poured toy forces across it. My brothers were crackshot Marines. I had a team of Tommies and Jerrys, little grey men, little green men, from one or other world war, quite real, except for their feet, which swooped into surfboards. They couldn't swim, they couldn't drown, and seemed at home in our terrain of rock pools, fissures, and weed. A colonel might rise on a limpet and lecture a shrimp face to face. He who is not with us is against us. And we were Olympians thundering. The ambient cartoon flourishes. Gott im Himmel. Gotcha. Verboten. These days, listening to Good Vibrations, I like to imagine my tiny conscripts disarmed, stripped down to their briefs, beginning to surf out of Galway Bay with a hint of blonde in their quiffs and empty hands fighting for balance. This next poem is also about a game, a slightly different kind of game involving no avatars, this time involving ghosts. It's about a game my brother and I used to play as children, a kind of provisional game that we used to use to take up the time on our journeys to the West. I'm from Dublin. We spend a lot of time in the west of Ireland, in Galway, and most of the poems in this book kind of feature Galway settings or on the road to Galway, as this poem is. And the game was basically to designate the headlights of oncoming cars at night as ghosts, who we would call Charlie and Joe. And the idea of the game was to identify the ghosts in the distance. Charlie and Joe, Charlie and Joe. Say, keep saying that until the ghosts had passed. Hide in the meantime behind the back seat and then kind of pop up and wait for the next set of ghosts to come along. It's Charlie and Joe, it's Charlie and Joe. And so on and so forth. We keep playing this like all the way, basically down to Galway, which is a game that our parents like very much. This is called Charlie and Joe. Why was Charlie Charlie? Why was Joe Joe? And why did we call the road west the road west when we drove east in it as much as west? Perhaps with all its islands and sun showers, the western side of Ireland so enlarged us. It drew the eastern into itself, until east was a part of west, the eastern part of west. Like they say that earth is part of God, but God is more himself elsewhere. And the road itself, why was it most a road at night, when the landscape around it shivered off into a starscape, when mingled with the stars were planes, planets, street lamps and satellites. As cat's eyes down the middle of the road blinked over and over in white and gold, smoothly dividing the blaze of headlights from the milder glow of crimson taillights, my brother and I would fight on the back seat to divide ourselves with an invisible line. Father watched us in the rearview mirror. Mother flicked open her vanity glass, and the little Zodiac dashboard glowed. Our hatchback, true, was not a full-fledged starship. Our back seat, true, was not a high-tech cockpit. But from inside the Volkswagen we could see the same outer space as any space pilot. And when, like stars coming down to our level, the headlights of any oncoming car would calmly return our open-faced stare, a and shortly come back for another look. We would always call them Charlie and Joe. Any names would have done but our own, for we believed they were just like us, two brothers, separate but inseparable, who always went everywhere together. And when they had gone and left us alone, our arms would widen, our hands would open, and we settled down to hugging the road with weightless imagined steering wheels. The Milky Way would sway from left to right as our hands flashed through the higher gears. What we saw, we thought. What we thought, we saw. For say the car was veering towards a luminous sign for crossing deer, then a deer was sure to leap from behind it. Say a torch was flashed by the side of the road, it was surely related to Charlie and Joe. And say we saw a red shape in the sky, slowly somersaulting through its trail of sparks, as we did one journey near Ballinasloe. Then it was the vast mothership from Close Encounters, not our mother letting a cigarette go. Okay, some of the poems in this book also involve islands, quite a lot of the islands off the Galway coastline, particularly one which is very near where we used to holiday in Kilkeeran, Kilkeeran Bay near Carna. And the island nearby, one of the islands nearby, is called Finnish Island. Some of you might know it. It's an island that's abandoned late 1950s, I think early 1960s. And one of the odd features of it is that the island is now half sand, half a very white sand, which has kind of come in to invade the usual Connemara dry stone walls, so that you have these dry stone walls sort of pointlessly enclosing this really kind of peculiar white sand, a really weird mixture. It's one of those islands you can walk out to and walk back from if you're quick. And a couple of times I've sort of nearly half drowned my friends coming back from this island. And this poem is about that place and about the experience of visiting it. And it's called Finnish Island. You cannot walk to an island unless, at low tide, it is not an island. You cannot leave the mainland unless the mainland is already an island. Europe is part of an island. Ireland, an island, is part of Europe. The Irish for island is Inish, and the island of Finnish is Irish. Ireland is islands. Europe is Ireland's. The blue-green globe on the Ormolu console glitters with the pergola's inclusive glow. The cool niche of the Shrewnosary Bridge, the Fountain of Inches, the shiny rose trellis, the blue tiles glowing in diamonds and squares are almost still in the infinite breeze. The cows hide their heads behind their bodies as if the wind had cut their throats. The heron swivels his bill to weenish. You cannot find a roof between the gables. You cannot find a floor between the walls. You cannot see your shoes deep in the sand, but you can feel them twist in the rabbit holes. You cannot open a door, but you can walk through empty door frames. You cannot get out of the wind unless you get off the island. You cannot see the islanders, they are long gone, but you can enter the islanders' houses, the beachheads of their living rooms, and you can meet the persistent spray, entering one window after another. Okay, well that gives you the flavour of that first book. And those poems, I suppose, are relatively traditional, seen through a certain lens. The second book is rather different in tone and texture, so I'm going to concentrate a bit more on that one. It's kind of a movement from the West to the Midwest, if you like, or from Galway to Minnesota. And the book deals quite a lot with... I was in Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota, for 2 years, teaching a liberal arts college called McAllister. And while I was there, I suppose one of the things that I found most alien being there was car culture. The first time I got to St. Paul, I was kind of just walked outside my flat, looked around on the street and kind of thought, there must be a truck convention in town. Why, you know, why are there all these trucks around? And basically, I was encountering the first time, it was 2001, the fact that half the people were driving SUVs. So SUVs became a kind of big thing when I was there. And in America, at the time anyway, and perhaps still, SUV is seen by people of a liberal persuasion as a kind of devil car. Basically, if you drive an SUV, it's a sort of kind of a reflection on your character. You know, not a good thing, particularly in an English department, to be driving in an SUV. You know, if anyone was driving it, they kind of said, well, it's sort of more like a, you know, a family car. You know, it's for the kids. Basically, a lot of my reflections on this book are on that car culture. And cars come in and out of the come in and out of it. Also reflections on the kind of accents that were used and the kinds of ways of life that attached to the way that people spoke there. So this first poem that I'm going to read is called A Clown Lounge. It's after my favourite bar in St. Paul, just below a place called the Turf Club. A friend who brought me out there, a guy called Steve Burt, who's now a Harvard professor and kind of well-known American poet critic, he kind of knew that before I got there that I was going to have to be provided with a bar that I would like. And so he did some scouting. This wasn't the kind of places he wouldn't normally go himself. Eventually wrote me an email and said, the good news is that we found a bar that we think you'll like. The bad news is it's full of pictures of clowns. So this is the Clown Lounge. And through the poem, it involves some of the voices that you would hear over the radio in Minnesota. It's a kind of a tone poem involving kind of a fair number of local references. For example, one of them is the Boston Radio Car Talk program, which is a really funny program I used to enjoy on Saturday mornings, which is hosted by two twin brothers who basically get people to ring in with their problems about cars and basically talk about everything in life, you know, just very humorously. Great, it's a great program. Its tagline at the end is, don't drive like my brother. And then the other guys say, don't drive like his brother, you know, that kind of thing. So that kind of makes its way into the poem, as do a few other kind of local references. The Clown Lounge. From the Clown Lounge to the Mall of America, with love and kisses, can you pass the CD? It's under your seat. From the sole copy of Fargo in stock. Context? To the SUVs parked on the lake. I cannot believe she drives one. From wearing shorts all winter to swallowing bong water. From walk-in wardrobes to Kofi on the web page. From emo rock and rent-a-wreck to monster trucks and ostrich on a stick. There are seats at the front, you should just come in. From Greg's driving, I never hit anything, to Nick's capture of a traffic cone without stopping. Don't drive like my brother. From the dead bat on the department floor, watch out, it could give you rabies, to student response sheets. Don't set self-portrait in a convex mirror again, it is bad. From barmen who wear hats, unless you don't want to come in, to the goths and gamers sitting furthest from the door. Hi, welcome to our conversation. From the pillar of fire above an Indian casino, do you want to come in? To the roadside approaching Lake George, bump. From Operation Enduring Imperialism, I thought it would be a small Chicago, to the soccer moms in outer ring suburbs, but it isn't. From not getting the stone roses, to not getting Ted Hughes, he's too straight for me. From the wrong side of the car, I'm sorry, to the logging towns which cut down northern Minnesota, and they're proud of it. From never meeting a frat boy, that works, to never meeting a Republican. You should vote for my dad. He has a good heart. From the secret highway exit for St. Paul, did I apologize for my driving? To the best liberal arts college in urban Minnesota. From Jessica Lange's cheekbones, could some of your posters not be of white male writers? To a quiet tradition of streakers. From the Katydids that Forrest brought to class, true visionaries don't know the meaning of no. To that slow lunar smudge above the Clown Lounge. Time to dust the sky for fingerprints. From me to you, Mac, with hugs and kisses. You should totally come in. Come in, and don't drive like his brother. Okay, this is a movement to up north of St. Paul. There's a place which became famous. Sorry, I was going to drink my wine. There's a place that became famous for, unfortunately, for a schoolyard shooting, like a lot of places in the States, called Bemidji. And before, I drove up there with a writer called Diane Glancy before that happened, and hadn't heard of the place beforehand. It's a place between three Ojibwe reservations, and it was kind of interesting. We went up at a time of year when it was really pretty cold. Minnesota gets very cold. And one of the aspects of car culture which I suppose fascinated me there was the way in which SUVs could drive out on lakes, and in fact sometimes drive into them, particularly when the ice was too thin at one or other point of the ice fishing season. So ice fishing was also something which rather fascinated me, and the idea that, you know, you would go out at particularly cold times of the year in a kind something rather like a portaloo cabin, and basically cut a hole in the ice and sort of stay there reading the odd paper, apparently these ice fishing villages get so extensive that they actually have their own postal addresses, so you can kind of have your mail delivered out to the out onto the ice if you desire. But what really stuck with me was the idea of SUVs going into the ice. And so this was a kind of wish fulfillment revenge kind of poem about that sort of thing. So it's just called Bemidji. The last American of the season has collapsed through the ice. The ice fishing village has gone. The lake hovers out of winter with its last ice fishing house, empty as an afterlife with one refrigerator. It could be yours, this life, that SUV, to scrape across a sunlit outer space before the Mississippi weakens with the yet to be caught swerving beneath you, with all the rusting of the yet to be retrieved. Bemidji, where the water crosses, the Ojibwe word for the lake, upholds a lakeside town as it whitens each year with discovery. You would drive out there with windows down to open your door in the pressure. Okay, this next poem kind of sort of introduces the theme of computer games, which does indeed run through this book. There can't be many of you who haven't played Grand Theft Auto, so I probably don't really need to explain it to you. But to those few people who maybe haven't, Grand Theft Auto is a game which often features in the tabloid newspapers, one of those kind of evil computer games. Well, it is a fairly evil game, actually, which is mainly about you being a hood, your avatar being a kind of a hood, who runs around performing mob missions and occasionally killing various bystanders on the street, especially if he's not driving too well. You can drive onto pavements and basically total lots of citizens. And the game is kind of about stealing cars, also about killing people and accumulating money. However, I mean, that's one way of looking at it, and that's kind of the tabloid way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that it is a kind of example of a kind of virtual freedom. You're in a space which has a peculiar realism. And I started actually playing this game after I returned from America and was living in Liverpool. And the odd thing about the game was it made me feel nostalgic. So the game was a kind of vehicle for nostalgia, because it didn't remind me of my mob missions, but it reminded me of basically of driving around in America. And it was very kind of very realistic feeling of what, you know, various places felt like, or turning corners or going into alleyways or whatever it might be. So the idea of computer games as a vehicle for nostalgia, well, they can be a vehicle for anything, is kind of partly in the background to a lot of the poems here. And this one is a kind of fun poem, really, which gives you the sense of some of the movement of playing the computer game. One of the issues with the game, one of the big things with it, is that sound is very important. Basically, when you steal a car and you start driving around, the radio comes on and it will often flick across channels according to what you do. And so some of those channels that come on, which kind of mimic, you know, urban radio stations and, you know, crazy radio stations with preachers or whatever it might be, or strange advertising or, you know, silly stuff like that, that comes on and provides this kind of interesting punctuation to the driving around. So sound is pretty important, and that comes into the poem too. So it's just called Grand Theft America. Though upside down, my burning stick shift leapfrogs Chinatown. Hey, learn how to drive! Though crashed to bits, my crumbling Hummer outguns the runaway underground train. And though bumpy men with baseball bats rebuff my tiny life, take him out, I will make a junction to pinch a jalopy. Suspect thinks he can play fast and loose with the law with a flick of the pinky switch. From first to third to first person view. You know something? I am hot tonight. Full on front end, a hatchback, and thrill. With a slow-mo jump across the rush hour to the darkened light of police helicopters blowing apart in boot-sole view. And I will wait till the kettle pulls itself off. You see, the passion, she is back. Let my left hand drift to my left cheek. Park myself deep in the alleyway murk. Press middle finger to exit. And twitch, or go round and round, and twitch. And I will let my right hand explore my chin jut till sundown. And I will check out the arc of my shotgun. How good this tastes. As America loads in the background. Okay, and the next poem, this is definitely going to be the most difficult thing. This is from the long poem here. Okay, and this involves a certain amount of exposition, unfortunately. Basically, the long poem is about a multi-user dimension. The multi-user dimension is rather like, to those of you who play graphic computer games, is rather like Second Life or World of Warcraft. Second Life of World of Warcraft, those games where, basically online games where people form a virtual communities, many people at once occupying a space, playing out roles according to defined themes. World of Warcraft, Dungeons & Dragons kind of theme. Second Life, a kind of contemporary life theme. Just, you know, like your Second Life, except more glamorous. Unlike those games, though, it involves no graphics. It's all text. So it's an early version of those games where everything is registered as text. You type in a command, you see something register on screen. Like you type, go west, and then you enter a cheery glade full of elves or whatever it might be. The game that I use here is, in fact, a kind of Dungeons & Dragons-style game. And you follow your avatar around within this kind of atmosphere. And within the game, as in many of these computer games, death is not the end, basically. When you die, you generally reset and come back again. And what I'm going to read to you is, I think, the most digestible bit of the piece is a death sequence. Now, because the coders of these games want death to mean something, they want death to be involved and not to happen too regularly and be too easy, death sequences tend to be long and involved and kind of boring. When the game I used to play involved Death, who is a kind of a giant figure, throwing you into a furnace, your little figure thrown into a furnace, and then some Monty Python characters kind of came along and started whistling, "Always look on the bright side of life." And this would kind of go on for an annoying period of time so that you would really not want to die. And then eventually you would reset. Where you reset is normally within something like a church or a temple, which is in fact what happens in the game here. You lose some powers and abilities and so on. So this is a kind of a parody of a death sequence that occurred on, you know, in one of these multi-user dimensions, one of these virtual games, and it involves a little bit of there are a few conventions in the game. There's a kind of there are channels where you can speak to people of like-minded people who usually often form things like guilds or teams, and these channels are, you know, only visible or audible to people who are in the guild, and the so-called guild lines. A line that's open only to people who are kind of your persuasion, and they're represented in the text here by italics. So I'm just going to render that to you with this kind of symbol. That means italics, and also there are obviously there are commands as well, where you're typing in things that induce a response. So I'm going to do that for a command. There aren't too many commands, and there are a few things in italics, but you kind of get the picture. It's basically an over-the-top death sequence from the game. So you die. You notice a tear in the fabric of reality. It starts very far up. It goes very far down and splits you precisely in half. The tear gets wider as Death's craggy knuckles struggle in. He is opening you methodically, like an egg. The guildmaster, his heart in flames, records the passing of Ferdia from the material plane. Weaselfish acts. Fanboy acts. Lurkio doubles over and pukes. Tundra Panic goes white and faints. Zigzag sits in dark thought on the rainy stair. Your grainy contents explode into the tear. Umpa acts. There is no size. There never has been. Death pushes a whole finger through. His finished hand is at once all sizes there ever have been, all sizes there ever will be, all sizes there ever could be. Death's finger is the size of Death's arm, is the size of your finger, is the size of your arm, is the size of you. Off goes stiff in his saddle and falls off his horse. Chosenhelm lays the body of Ferdia on a makeshift skiff. He covers the body with much beloved things, then steps back solemnly. He touches a burning brand to the skiff and sets it adrift on dark reflecting waters. Death's eye looks fixedly out of the meal he has made of you. Your mouth is forced open as wide as it can go, then wider. Death tumbles inside with the six wet arms. Bee de Quiver puts down his drink, beer flowing magnificently from his chin. He looks from face to face around the bar, murdering a slow elfin keen in Ferdia's memory. He starts to swallow your throat from the inside. He starts to swallow you and your throat. With his six strong arms, Death clings to the surface of your soul like a small black lizard. He chews happily in time with the endless bobbing of blue cosmic waves.
Cuckoospell sees the deeds of Ferdia written out in soft white letters, which meander gently to the stars. His reptilian face keeps changing. It is trying on all the expressions you have ever worn and ever will have worn. His smile is a crack within a crack. He is chewing things over. He begins to look mildly disappointed. He runs through all the mildly disappointed faces you have ever attempted. Finally, he shakes the shapelessness of his head and laughs. You know, mortal one, you really can't get good soul these days. Death brings up everything he has swallowed. Above the shiny black tumult, he spits you out very high and very, very far, as if there truly were a thing called size. You splatter against a stone wall and stick. Then you start rolling down. Jack Frost stares grimly from the summit. Your surroundings seem familiar. The Church of St. Kieran. A big rabbit wineskin of pina colada, almost empty. A small white card. Some tights. A sprig of St. John's wort. A large bulletin board mounted on the wall. Uberscram the Chevalier is here. Some mist is here. Sleeving the Sneak is lying here, dead. Tundrapanic the Missionary is writing a message here. The village watchman is here, ensuring domestic tranquility. The watchman glows with a bright light. Obvious directions, north, south. Lurkio's magic carpet is almost whole by the star of Ferdia rising. Pray. You roll to the bottom of the wall and reappear in material form. Some mist leaves south. Get sprig. You get the St. John's wort. Zigzag pats his pocket for a reality pill. Heal wounds. You carefully apply St. John's wort to your wounds. Beastmoke stops at the end of the balcony, murmuring to herself. Folded in time is that sailing day, through the rapt distresses of a waterfall. A sky with a face too big to take in at once. A sea of faces which took us in completely, and are being taken in by an island of delf and chivalry, and shiny, haphazard shelves, which repeatedly drifted, like the self, into a pattern of contemplation, a dolphin with a look of almost elfin satisfaction. Okay, that's the difficult bit. I'll just move on to... I'll do it for time. I'll just move on to a poem about two cats. This is kind of a lighter poem. And like many of the academics I knew out in the States kept cats, I suppose many people do. And a friend of mine particularly had two cats who really didn't get on. One cat being... sort of young, athletic, and really stupid, and the other cat being old and very, very lazy. And this is about these two cats which basically didn't get on anyway whatsoever. And it's called Double Felix. Her fur is for portraiture. His purr is far more appreciative. Rough comparison affects a pair, togetherness as of two paws, though side by side, the compared stare apart, their pursuits separate. Sloth, hers. Ladybugs, dust, and her, his. All night, he pursues her, but for fun, nothing further. Okay, and a poem about, kind of a goodbye to St. Paul poem. It's called St. Paul with a question mark. St. Paul, in order to kind of give you a sense of... not really knowing what to make of a place, and it was a place I never really quite came to terms with. And this poem, I suppose, is a kind of a question to myself about it. So it's just called St. Paul. St. Paul, what can I say? In a way that says it all? I look for your pavements, so expertly kept, under my boot soles. Swift after snowfall, your householder's brushes appear to swish all death traps away. Yet one house with Wiccan symbols strove to be odd, odd as in an exception. I think of you two as swept back somehow, like my landlord's fretful office lady, holding yourself in with a permanent Alice band, saying should with the startled eyebrows of a facelift. And as for religion, on the road to St. Cloud, your heavenly-sounding neighbour, I would never actually see. I read the adopt-a-highway signs as all there was to read. So much for conversion. At night, leaving work, the one place I had to walk, not a soul would be abroad. Meanwhile, your houses, rich and graciously lit, crash together like regular ice cubes. That your police shut parties down. That my snowball-throwing students had to flee, being underage. That no one was poor, though everyone was needy. These two say it all. Would you like a cat? A mood so you. Neither interrogative nor imperative, but both at once. We won't be angry if you say no, but we will be sad. Everything worked. So everyone did. Okay, I'm just going to end with two elegies. My father died in 2001, around the time of my first book coming out. And so really, this book is actually quite elegiac. In fact, I think of the long poem as being really an elegy. If kind of at base, that's what its form is. Just a, in the way that a computer game can be about nostalgia, a computer game can also be an elegy. And I think MUDs can perform that role if you want them to. But these two poems are kind of more straightforward elegies. First one is called Frisk. When he ambled out of the world and shut the door, I wonder what my father found with a swift, nervy frisk was left behind. I'm a fool, he'd say this aloud, the way I do sometimes, leaving the flat, turning back for some necessary trash, opening the door as he is coming out. And this final poem, well, this is also an elegy, a slightly different one, slightly more offbeat one, and it features the Irish word for lobster, which is dlumach, a word which is kind of ought to be celebrated in itself, I suppose, dlumach, and also a phrase in Irish which gets repeated in the final line of the poem. So I'll wait for the final line to, as it were, translate it. So it's just called dlumach. Over the Inver, the universe blows. Father dives into the hereafter. Where? Here. The vanishing point of authoritative shoulders. Stars wend. What? Heavens weave between wide-angled jungles of seaweed. As he pours in, here, upside down, a slow flow of reflections from his mouth. Is Fornach an oich of Ifor Dlumach? Smoking us out in Irish, one more time. Where is here? Pulling back evergreen waves of structure. It's a queer place you would find a lobster.
Cheers, thanks.